This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, Season 9, Episode 29. And welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the ConcealedCarry.com network, brought to you by HK. Today is Wednesday, March 20th, 2024, as the recording of this particular episode. I am your host, Riley Bowman, and joined today by co-host and founder of all things that we do here, I guess, Jacob Paulson.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
Yeah. Who is the man that used to drive a Honda Civic that honked at you when you turned the steering wheel?
Yeah, it was great times. Yeah, there was some point in the radius of the steering wheel. I'm sure a half-handy person could have fixed this. But this... I'm a Paulson, and we were not handy. So, yeah, you just turn the wheel and honk. Then you'd come back straight and honk again. Just move on.
So that was the conversation we were just having before we went live. And I thought, hey, you know what? It's been a long time since we did a guy who or a man who, you know.
It's true.
Opening intro of the podcast. So, anyway, we are glad to be with you all. It's actually been a while since Jacob and I have done the podcast together. Not necessarily, you know, intentional that way, but just, you know, you're busy. We're all busy. But today you're here with me. So we're going to talk about 6 required behaviors to stop negligent discharges, which actually Jacob did a really great job writing up an article about this very subject. So we're going to break that down and discuss it with you all here today. I think it'll be a worthwhile discussion. So first, though, today's episode is sponsored, brought to you by Barrel Block. And that is... BARRELBLOK. I always make sure to spell because sometimes people probably search barrel block with a CK.
Or barrel. I mean, I have to spell check myself on barrel all the time. People, 2 L's on accident, 1 R. It's just, don't expect me to remember these things.
Barrel block's going to be very relevant to our discussion here today as a safety dry fire training device. Talking about negligent discharges and preventing them. So we will just definitely talk about that today. Check out barrel block by going to barrelblock.com. Also, today's episode is sponsored by KSG Armory Holsters, which, as you know, that's one of our other sub-brands. And in fact, we got guys on the other side of that wall. They're making holsters right now as fast as they can. If you're waiting on a holster order, just know we're cranking them as best we can. KSG Armory Holsters, top quality holsters made by people that actually shoot and train and try to actually incorporate what we've learned over the years into the design of those holsters to make sure they work for you. And most importantly, as is relevant to today's topic, they are safe. That is absolutely number one and foremost, is that they are safe holsters, but then also allow you to train and shoot and draw and do all those things super, super well. And of course, conceal really well too.
And be comfortable doing it.
Yep, that's right. All those things. KSGArmory.com to learn more and check out the full lineup of holsters. The Lexington is our top model, very, very popular model. If you're interested in light bearing, we have a number of options for guns with different lights called the Revere holster. We have the Declaration holster if you're looking for something simple or something that's Enigma optimized. If you are a user or might be a user of the Filster Enigma product, you can use our Declaration holster with those or with that. And a bunch of other great products as well on KSGArmory.com. Let's get into the topic today. 6 required behaviors to stop negligent discharges. I think probably, you know, one place to start, Jacob, is several years ago, we spent quite a bit of time compiling, researching, putting together a pretty extensive collection of stories of negligent discharges, people that had a gun go off. Say negligently discharged. I mean, it could have been because they truly negligently did something wrong or incorrect or whatever. You know, it was more of an active thing on their part. Or sometimes it's just something that people failed to do more maybe on the passive side. But either way, at the end of the day, what we don't want to have happen is a gun that just goes off.
Yeah, what the most universal term we could use is just unintentional.
Yep.
The gun, we did not intend for it to go off. That research was interesting. I think we paid someone in Pakistan or something to go on the internet and search for and find examples of, you know, unintentional discharges of guns. And we used a sample period of 2 years. I think at that time, I think that the years we were looking at were either 2017 and 2018 or 2016, 2017, doesn't matter. But it was a 2 year period and it was only in the US. And they scraped together every unique example they could find of a news story, on some definitely credible website, news website.
Right.
And I think we ended up with like 298. So at that time, we published an article called 300 Negligent Discharges, and we shared a bunch of the information, the data that we learned from that article. But I was sitting around now several weeks ago, and I was thinking, okay, well, like, it's good that we know some things about NDs. We know where they're most likely to take place. We know, believe it or not, what day of the week or what month of the year they're likely to happen. We know whether or not they're handguns or long guns. We know whether or not people are likely to hurt themselves or somebody else by or anybody at all is likely to get shot. But what we didn't answer is perhaps the most important question, which is, well, how could these have been prevented? Like, what is the proactive thing or behavior or attitude that, if followed, would have prevented these? Right. And so now, several weeks ago, I went back and I just reread all 300 of these news stories.
You read 300 news stories?
Reread. I had previously read them all.
No, I know. I think I come through a lot of them as well.
Yeah, but so I reread all of them.
Holy cow.
And I also grabbed a handful of, I'll call them modern, more recent ones in more recent history. And I was looking for the ones that tend to be more viral, that people probably seen the video on YouTube or things like that. So I probably, I don't know, my final universe of stories I was looking at might have been 330, 340 stories, somewhere in that ballpark. But I reread them all because I was saying to myself, as I was reading them, I said, okay, what is the behavior that if followed would have prevented this one? Mm. Right? And I didn't know, that was the attitude I had going into it. And I wasn't sure, by the time I was done, if I was going to end up with a list of 12 things, 20 things, but as it were, there were six. Six behaviors, or attitudes, if you prefer. I call them behaviors. Six behaviors that, if followed, all the negligent discharges I was able to ever find and read about would have been prevented.
There you go. That's a good introduction to what we're here to discuss today then. So without further ado, do we just jump into these?
Yeah, I'll just issue one warning before we get into number one. And that warning is that you need to make this personal. There's a tendency when the data shows this, and my arbitrary experience suggests this as well. There's a tendency when we talk about things like this for the listener who's listening to this podcast or watching this video recording of this podcast to tune this out. To basically convince yourself this wouldn't happen to you. That you're not a danger. You're a good, reasonable, responsible gun owner, and therefore, of course, you would always act in a way that's responsible. And as an extension of that, then you would never have a negligent discharge.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, these are not behaviors that are natural or inherently automatic and happening all the time. So all of us are equally vulnerable, and you need to listen to these and say, okay, I have to adopt these behaviors in an almost fanatic religious way. In order to ensure this doesn't happen to me.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, the article that Jacob wrote that we're using as a reference point for today's episode will be posted into the show notes of this episode as well. So be sure to check that out so you can read and go through that all yourself. And also, there's a link within that. And maybe I'll just go ahead and include the link also in the show notes just for convenience. If you want to go and see all the research that was done on the 300 negligent discharges from several years ago, you can also do that. I was thinking, as far as making it personal, one of the, I think, the best well-known examples of the importance of that, of what you just explained, as far as people thinking, well, that wouldn't happen to me. Like, I wouldn't make that mistake, because I'm me and I'm awesome. Would probably have to be that ATF or DEA agent that's caught on camera where he lights off a round into his foot or ankle in front of a class.
Yeah. Yeah. We got an FBI agent who cooked off a round in a nightclub. We had a shooting at an ATF training in Arizona last week. I mean, how hard would it be on Google to find a bunch of cops who have accidentally shot each other?
Yep.
I'm aware of three of those in the last 24 months. So, yeah, trained people have this problem. I hate to suggest that, if it hasn't happened to you, it will one day. I'm happy to believe that there are gun owners, and there will be gun owners who spend an entire life without having a negligent discharge.
Sure.
But I've had one, so I'm open to the reality that it could happen to me again if I don't exercise absolute prudent judgment.
Yeah. It's funny. I was just having a conversation with someone recently about this very thing and about how, they haven't had one yet. And they were having a conversation with several other people that had had several each or multiple each, well, including one that had had four.
Yeah, go read the comments at the bottom of the article that we're linking to in the show notes. And I think you'll be shocked by some of the comments. I mean, some people who with some pretty significant pedigrees who admit to having had negligent discharges. And I think it's humility is necessary. That's the point of this little disclaimer in this conversation we're having right now before we get into the six behaviors, is that if there's a seventh behavior, it's humility. Because if you approach this with some amount of ego and sense of pride, then you're set up for failure.
Yeah. Yeah, totally, 100%. Yeah, if anything, those of us that spend a lot of time around firearms, if we are truly not careful and sort of keep ourselves in check and humble and whatever else you want to, you know, kind of think of that as, it's perhaps even more likely it could happen to many of us because we're just, I mean, certainly the opportunities for it to happen are much greater.
Statistical probability-based opportunity.
Perhaps our world than, you know, someone that more casually handles a firearm.
Also increased probability based on complacency, right? The odds of becoming complacent increase over time.
Yep.
But hopefully also repetition leads to some skill related to these behaviors.
Yep, totally. Well, should we bring up the first one here?
Do it.
Number one, administrative handling.
Oh, administrative handling.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let me give you just two that come to my mind right away. So we had this, and neither of these are in the study, by the way. These are both more recent than the study of 300. But we have a guy in Missouri who's on his way home. Stops at a red light, decides to make an adjustment to his concealed gun in his pants. And we don't know exactly what happened. We're making some assumptions based on what we do know. But he cooked off a round inside of his own vehicle, shot himself in the leg, pulls over to the side of the road, calls 911. He's on hold for 38 seconds. No one picks up the phone. Excuse me, a minute and 38 seconds before anyone picks up the phone. He disconnects it. And is found later dead in his sitting inside the road in his truck by his wife, who was following his route home to see where he might be. We have a guy.
I remember that one. We just talked about that on a recent podcast.
Yeah, it's pretty recent. Yeah. You know, maybe a year ago.
Yeah.
There's a picture in the article of this dude in a gun store who pulls out his gun. He's got a question for the guy behind the counter. Pulls off his gun, cooks off a round. I mean, I got a dozen stories like that one that happened in gun stores. So yeah, this idea of administrative handling, like administrative handling equals increased probability. It's kind of two for one in this behavior. One half of the behavior is let's reduce administrative handling. Like less of it is better. And the other half of the behavior is, and this is probably the more relevant thing that someone needs to take away from this conversation, is when you do administrative behavior, leave the gun in the holster. Because the vast majority of NDs I found relating to this particular behavior happened because the gun was outside of the holster when it didn't need to be. The gun could have remained in the holster. So Riley's pulling his gun out right now, for those who are watching the video. And he was able to do that without removing the gun from the holster. So gun stayed in holster, right? So administrative handling.
Easy to do.
Yeah, it's you know, right? So, oh, I need to get it out of the safe. I need to put it in the safe. I need to, I'm pulling up to a post office. I need to leave it in the car before I go into the post office or the kid's school for the thing. Like, okay, like. I'm going to the bathroom in a restroom. Like these are all situations where some administrative gun handling is requisite. It has to happen. But can you just leave the gun in the holster and remove the holster? Because that's the behavior that reduces ND probability a significant way. I'll give you something that's even active range, and that is like swapping mags. Can you swap mags without removing your gun from the holster? If not, that's something you might want to consider tweaking about your holster or buying a new holster for. Because all that kind of administrative handling, safety on and off, swapping mags. And Riley just dropped his mag without removing the gun from the holster.
Easy.
So those are, you know, that's one category. Like that was a clear trend in the data.
Yep. Yeah. Totally agree. And that's something that as a practice, I've tried to abide by for a lot of years now. I mean, you saw how easy it is to just pull this out of my pants just as a unit and drop that into the safe just like that. I actually prefer that, including if I need to go and actually retrieve that from said safe in a perhaps even in a low light, sudden type, you know, kind of situation where it's like, what's going on? What, you know, am I even thinking straight? And rather than reaching in there, maybe inadvertently snatching the trigger, I can pull this out with the holster and it's really not that big a deal for me to.
Well, yeah. And you might be glad to have that holster. Maybe you want to strap it on as you go run towards the incident.
Right. That's certainly an option. And it's really no big deal to you know, I can use my thumb and snatch that off.
In fact, I'm remembering you and I met a guy he was running. He had a radio show here in Denver. You and I were on that show once.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And he also he shot himself in a car once when he was doing some administrative handling. So,
oh, yeah.
Remember?
That's right. Oh, man. That's a long time ago.
That was
now.
A long time ago. But administrative handling equals I mean, I got another one. We had a cop in Indianapolis. This is all on surveillance video. He's in an elevator with his wife. They're at a mall. They're doing some shopping. They're going down or up in the elevator. Same thing. Pulls out the gun. He's just checking the gun. Like, you know, what's up with that? I don't know. Checking some status thing with the gun. Pops off around right there in the elevator.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, so Christy on YouTube says, I had an instructor flip out on me for doing a clean mag change in my holster. And I'm sorry you had an instructor flip out on you like that. I was just thinking, I just taught a class in San Diego this last weekend. Great bunch of students. And it's a question, if I fail to proactively address this, which sometimes I do, and I did in this particular class, you know, inevitably the question will get asked, oh, is it okay if I swap mags out while on the holster? And I'm like, oh, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Like, no
yeah, behind
problem.
The line. No yeah, like if the gun doesn't leave the holster.
Right. I think one reason why maybe some instructors see an issue with that is that they're concerned that that there will be some kind of almost like maybe a, what's the word? Like a training scar or something might be developed or something, you know, like that's not the right way to swap out a mag. Like, and if you're going to see the mag, well, I do know that one of the risks of doing that, especially like in a class environment, or I guess really any time, would be that you fail to actually get a magazine fully seated when you make the swap.
Sure, sure. Okay.
You know, because you're not doing it in the standard fashion and you're not actually, you know, really firmly in seating it, or at least there's the potential for that. I know I've seen that. And I know I've seen that in class.
But you can still give it a tug.
Where someone, you know, pulls the trigger and their mag falls out.
I mean, when I do an administrative one, I this sounds weird, but I interlace my fingers and with my palms on one on top of the gun, on top of my red dot, the other one on the base plate of the mag, I just squeeze really tight. And then I tug on the base plate. Like, yep. It's seated, so yeah, I get all you're saying, but I think mm-hmm. that it's also silly on the mm-hmm. surface.
Yeah,
if we can do administrative things without removing the gun from the holster, super bonus. Like we reduce ND probability in a significant way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I agree with that. And frankly, just in a class environment, I mean, as an instructor, it's so much things can run so much more smoothly. Like I was in California, it's already. You know, behind enemy lines, so to speak. And sure. Sometimes just having enough magazines to even do a class for some of these students, especially if they're newer, they just haven't had enough time to.
Well, they might run 10 round mags.
It's a huge bonus for them to be able to make use of every magazine. We just got done shooting a drill and they forgot to do or maybe they've shot everything basically dry. And it's like, yeah, you know, off the line, hit the button, pull your mag out, load it up, you know, because they're already only work. I think I had two students that only had three mags. So, you know,
I have to do this a ton because when I take gun classes, I'm not a competitive shooter. I'm a defensive shooter. So I don't like on a regular day, I don't walk around carrying three spare mags in my pocket.
Right.
So when I take classes, I generally have the mag in my gun. Maybe I'll strap on mag carry with one mag, spare mag, and then I'll just throw another one in a pocket. But I'm not rocking five spare mags on me like some of these people in these classes, which is fine if that's what they're training for. But I try and be as close to my normal loadout as possible. So, yeah, I'm doing administrative swaps all the time behind the line as I'm topping off mags.
Yeah, yep. And, of course, there's a whole bunch of other – we're kind of hyper-focusing on like one little aspect. But the point is can we reduce administrative handling with our guns and look for opportunities to do that? And the answer certainly is yes. And then also when we need to do administrative handling, including removing a gun from a holster – just let's make sure that we're really totally on top of what it is we're doing. I'm thinking of our safety rule as we teach it at concealedcarry.com, the rule that goes always be attentive when handling a firearm. I think that's what's kind of the juxtaposition here with what we're discussing is that administrative handling implies that it's kind of it's an administrative task. It's common. It can be mindless to a degree, you know, that it's just this thing you're doing to usually get a gun from point A to point B or that kind of thing, you know. And so it's a high risk moment in time where if you are not always if you're not always being attentive while doing that, you can see how this can be a problem, both in terms of paying attention to where the muzzle's pointing, where your finger is, all that kind of stuff.
Bingo. Yeah. So so there's three parts of this first behavior. One is, let's not do any administrative handling if we don't have to.
Yep.
Second is, if we can give the gun in the holster, like, super bonus. And third, in the occasion that you got to do some administrative handling where the gun has to leave the holster, okay, this has got to be an environment where I got to be flipped on, I got to be paying attention, I got to be focused, I have to have a certain degree of energy.
Yep, 100%. Let's move on to number two. Render the gun inert for dry fire and maintenance. There's a lot of ways that we can go about doing this, of course. I could actually probably come up with 5, 6, 7, I don't know, somewhere in that ballpark of things that I could actually do to a gun to render it essentially inert.
And you might have to do all of those at some point, depending on the situation.
Sure, sure.
Right. So I think that you got to have different tools in your toolbox to render a gun inert.
Yeah.
Because it's different if I'm rendering, you know, if I'm going to conduct dry fire, you know, in my basement or in my office or something at the house, and I'm going to, you know, do some draw and shoot stuff or whatever. That's different than I'm going to take this gun apart and clean it. You know, in right. both circumstances, we need to render the gun inert. We need to have a high degree of confidence that while we're performing this activity, the gun's not going to discharge. This is not administrative activity. This in the way we are defining it as a community, this is more, you know, and like I said in the rule, it's dry fire and it's maintenance, right? We're manipulating the gun on purpose for some objective. And so we need to render it inert to the best of our ability.
Yeah. First thing that comes to mind, and this is something that I've started doing, although I don't think I actually have it with me today, which is somewhat unusual, is carrying around with me a barrel block.
Yeah.
So barrel blocks are our product. We sell them. We've got a whole bunch of them in the warehouse right over there, if you're not already aware. And obviously, self-sponsoring the episode today, barrelblock.com. Like, please go check them out. But I started putting one in my back pocket because I typically do dry fire every day. To some extent, you know, like, it might be 20 draws from the holster or something.
Sure.
But, you know, one time I remember, you know, I'd get that feeling of, oh, let's just take 2 minutes and do 20 draws or whatever. And so I would just make sure I unloaded the gun and follow all the proper safety protocols and then do the thing. And then it was like, well, what if I just had, you know, the only reason I wouldn't use a barrel block is because I didn't have one handy in some of those circumstances. So it's like, why don't I just slip one in my back pocket? It doesn't take up any room.
Yeah.
It's not uncomfortable to have there at all. And so that's just what I started doing. And that's made a big difference as far as now I don't, you know, it's kind of like guilt-free, you know, dry fire, because I know that I'm doing it proper, that I'm, you know, I could be very safe. However, I just like that extra level of security and reassurance, especially if it's in my home, especially because I got, you know, a household of 7 people. And I mean, I can't be accountable for where they all are all the time.
Yeah.
And while I try to do most of my dry fire in the basement where I've got, you know, good solid walls surrounding me. Have I made exceptions outside that? Yeah, I have made exceptions from time to time. And so it's really easy to be like, hey, no problem. Barrel block in the barrel, guns inert. I can do what I need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, there's just, we have too many stories in the data set, you know, of holes in refrigerators and in TVs and in walls and in all sorts of places. And we could talk about attitudes, but this article and this episode, of course, then is not about attitudes. It's about behaviors, right? And when it comes to dry fire, there's all the things that everybody already knows you're supposed to do. Oh, we separate the ammo and we triple check the gun. And then we, you know, go into a different environment that's like a clean environment. Like all that stuff is good. But, it, you know, it's better, like, just render the gun inert. Like, make the gun so it can't work. That's the point here, is that I'm trying to elevate our thinking in terms of the behavior that we're going to perform. And that's dry fire. And, of course, then there's the maintenance thing, okay? I'm trying to think of some recent maintenance. You just put some new sights on a gun last week, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you know, put on new sights, or I got to clean the gun, or trying to think something I've done recently. Oh, I'm installing a dot, you know, or whatever the thing is. Like, those are things, the same thing. Like, let's render the gun inert. And you might be like, well, I'm going to take it apart into pieces. My gosh, like, you have any concept for how many articles are in, or how many news stories are in the data set of guns, of NDs taking place when someone was cleaning their gun?
Right.
Massive number.
It's either number one or number two for the most
activities. It's super common.
Common
for guns to go off when they're being cleaned. Like, well, it's super common when there is an ND for it to have taken place when a gun is being cleaned. So just render the gun inert. Like, just that's the behavior, right? Oh, I'm going to take this gun apart. You know, I just, you know, I'm going to clean it. Great. Like, how easy, how hard is it? Lock the slide back, stick the barrel block in. Okay, now I can break it down. Like, that stick is sticking out. So now I know I'm good. That's the thing. That's the, it's inert now, right? Mm-hmm. It can't fire. So yeah, unload the gun, remove the ammo, do all the things, but render it inert. That's the magic.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, we actually have an interesting question here. I thought it's worth addressing at least, or at least hitting on. I don't want it to go ignored necessarily. But Christy asks, if you're dry firing so often, do you discard your chambered defensive round after dry firing? At what point do you decide your defensive round has been chambered too much and is no longer reliable? And so, Christy, this is, I mean, a very valid question, and you would think I'd be chewing through defensive rounds all the time. A number of years ago, and I don't really talk about this publicly anymore, and so I'm going to be careful about what I say even right now. And that actually comes from having a instructor or friend that I respect actually get mad at me for sharing it once, not even as a post, but someone asked me a question directly, and I replied directly in a comment on a post once upon a time with what I do. And they felt like that was irresponsible of me to share a non-traditional technique of what I do to handle this situation. But the answer, Christy, is that I have a technique that I'm happy to talk with you offline about how I – and it's not like it's super complicated or rocket science or anything like that. It's just that it's not something that's probably the best to put out there in front of the eyes of – newer, lesser experienced gun owners, I guess is what I'm saying. But anyway, I don't have to worry about bullet setback hardly ever with the way I follow that procedure. And I'm still safe about it and everything, but...
But bullet setback is a potential issue.
So
you can address that in a number of traditional ways. You can rotate that round, you know, so you, sometimes you can dump the mag, shove that one down five deep, right? So you're not always, it's not always the same round. Or yeah, you can discard it, you know, or you can chuck it in a bag of like, this is stuff I'm going to stuff in the middle of the magazine. And so, you know, however you want to manage that.
And she says she gets visible bullet setback after two or three times of chambering the same round. That seems like, so I don't know what round you're using. I would say that from what I've used, that's not typical. Probably more like on the order of five or six, maybe sometimes eight times or so before I notice setback. I would say though, Christy, that my policy would be if I notice any setback at all, that would be the limit where I would discard or, you know, add that to my pile of whatever. And so, so that would be, so if you're getting after two or three rounds, that's, I don't know what round, you might look at a different round. I'm mostly carrying federal HSTs. I think I've heard that some of like the Hornady, like XTP or Critical Defense, and some of those might be a little more prone to setback from what I've heard. But I haven't carried or used those in so many years now that I don't know for sure personal experience wise. But anyway, something to be aware of if you are dry firing a lot. We were talking about rendering the gun inert. And so, yes, what are some other things that you can do? I would just mention that I've done this before where I have actually removed the back plate on a gun and made that so that, I mean, at that point, it can't function. So that's basically inert at that point. And I will also say this is more for me as an instructor on the range. I used to haul around with me a blue gun or a cert pistol or something to classes. And while I often still do have one of those with me, sometimes just easier and simpler and more convenient for me to use just the grip or the frame of my gun for certain demonstrations in class. So where basically I just disassembled the gun, I set the slide down into to the side, and then I just use the lower frame of the gun for demonstrations because, I mean, that's also inert. So there's a number of ways we can go about doing this number two thing of rendering a gun inert for dry fire, for maintenance, for demonstration purposes. Mm-hmm. Anything else we should have mentioned?
You can put a lock on it. You know, so you're that horrible, ridiculous, stupid cable lock that comes with your gun in most states or everywhere now. I don't know. Anyway, you can shove that thing through. You can put it through the chamber or whatever, and that renders the gun pretty dang freaking inert as you disassemble it or work on it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, may not be able to disassemble it with that
installed. Depending on the gun and how it's installed.
Yeah. But, yeah. So the point is, where possible and where it makes sense for your particular circumstance or situation, render the gun inert. Make it – just give yourself that extra little bit of reassurance that you're not going to have any issues.
Yep.
All right. So as we noted, that would have prevented a number of the negligent discharges from our study. Number three, proper storage in and outside the home.
This is the one that I think the media focuses on. This is the one that we see legislation oriented around. I am not a fan that of legislation or laws that force gun owners to secure their guns under whatever circumstances. I think that's utterly ridiculous. We have such a law here in Colorado, and there's a bill to expand on that law this year. We'll see where that goes. However, I also am a big fan of securing the gun when it's not in the immediate control of a responsible person. So I think that this is a self-police kind of thing. And make no mistake, a massive number of the NDs in our research are definitely correlated with this one. Like it's really simple. Mm-hmm. When gun not in immediate control of responsible human, gun locked up in thing. Like that's what we're going for.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so because we're not just talking, I mean, in this context, we're talking a lot of times about somebody else, somebody that's unauthorized right?
Yep. Yep.
And so the most common one that we see that is often ends in tragedy are younger children and kids and things getting a hold of a gun.
But I do have two stories in my data set of dogs shooting guns.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't there one where it was like it was a rifle in the bed of the pickup?
Yep. Dogs running around back there, steps on the trigger, bang, goes through the cab. Yeah. Hits the driver. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, I mean, number one, the odds of that happening are just incredible. Number two, it's like, why are we running around with a chambered loaded hunting rifle or whatever in the truck?
I don't know. I was about to speculate what state that could have been in, but I'd get in trouble. So that could have been in my home state. The point is, if gun not in your immediate possession or your immediate power, of any responsible adult, then the gun should be secured.
Yeah.
Like it should be secured. And that doesn't matter if it's in the car. It doesn't matter if we're talking at my campsite, in my tent. It doesn't matter if we're talking in my home. Like if it's not in the immediate control of a human, it should be secured somehow. And that would prevent a massive amount of unauthorized access. And that unauthorized access is often associated with or leads to a negligent discharge.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways we can go about doing that. You and I have both carried with us in our vehicles for years now, simple little, like Gun Vault's made the product for years. Is
sure.
The micro vault? Is that the little
one? I think so. Or it's the clamshell style thing. No, it's not the nano vault. The nano vault's the little key.
Yeah, so one. I think it's the micro vault.
I think it's the micro vault.
Yeah.
Or mini vault?
Anyways, I don't something know. Along those lines, right? Yeah, clamshell style. I mean, could the person ultimately, break their way or force their way into one of those products? Yeah, probably with enough time and tools and whatever, right? It's like not that, difficult per se, probably. But the point is that most of these kind of situations we're talking about are ones that happen relatively quickly, where, within minutes of a child. Maybe it's just being left unattended in a vehicle for a few minutes, right? They get themselves out of their seats. I mean, my kids have done it all the time over the years. And then they're messing around in the vehicle. And it's like, oh, hey, look, here's dad's gun.
I have two stories in the data set that are a gun left in mom's purse.
Yeah.
Kid accessed purse when purse was unattended, fired the gun.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. I got nothing wrong with a gun in a purse. Like, that's not a problem for me if it's done properly. But it is a problem that the purse is then left unattended.
Right.
Now we have an unsecure gun that's not in the immediate control or power of a responsible human.
Yeah. And this one is – so the whole concept here is let's not have unsecured, unattended firearms that someone can, that shouldn't have access gets access, right?
Bingo.
That crosses over a little bit into our next one. Which if you're ready, I'm happy to move on to that one.
Fire.
Which is talking about holsters.
Yeah, right? The next two are talking about holsters. So six behaviors, and behavior number four and five both relate to a holster. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you go read the comments on the article, this one's the only one I got a little bit of pushback on, but the person relented in the end. So yeah, Behavior number four is have a holster that properly protects the trigger. We have a number of stories, a dozen or more stories in the data set that specifically could have been prevented because if the person had been using a good holster. So right. It simply comes down to protecting the trigger. We've talked about this before in the podcast, but when we say protect the trigger, I'm thinking about two very specific things. First, that the holster has to fully cover the trigger guard, prevent access to the trigger guard via some gap in the holster. Right. So if I can hold my gun, I'm going to grab Riley's gun here. If I can hold the gun up in the holster and I can see into the trigger guard through some gap, then that's a fail. Like that would be a problem. Right. And then the second issue, in addition to, having to cover the trigger guard fully, is with the we have to cover the trigger guard fully with a material that's hard enough to prevent penetration.
Right.
Right. If I can take my finger or a pen or a knife and stick it into the holster and then work the trigger through the holster material, then that's also a problem. So that's behavior number four, is use a holster that properly protects the trigger.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So you mentioned a couple examples in the article here. You actually mentioned in this number four thing to do, to prevent negligent discharges, the story you told a moment ago of a child discharging mom's gun in the purse. Another one was a gun owner bumping the trigger in their pocket gun. Okay. And that's a huge concern, because I have known people and seen people that have just thrown a gun in their pocket, even, yeah. Without a holster,
yeah.
Even without what we might necessarily think is the ideal holster, or a holster that complies with our rules of holsters, in that, some of the softer sided pocket type holsters, but yes, this guy bumped his trigger somehow in his pocket gun. It goes off. Another one was a man shot himself with the zipper pull in his jacket, entered the holster.
That was a pretty recent one.
Yep. Yeah. And that's, I remember, man, going through academy level, law enforcement, our handgun training years ago, where, and I appreciate the instructor for doing this at that time. I mean, he looked at each of us that was on the line. And I remember going through, that was kind of like March-ish timeframe, if I recall. So in other words, it was kind of cooler weather and we're on a semi-outdoor range. It was covered, but it was outdoor, so not heated. So I mean, we're wearing jackets, right? And so he went along and looked at everybody. He's like, oh, you've got those little dangling things. You either need to make sure you get those all the way up at the top of the zipper. Don't let them down here where they're by your holster, or cut them off. I've seen some instructors that have been in classes that have been like, no tassels or dangling things off of zipper pulls and whatnot of your clothing. Let's take that off, kind of thing. So anyway, it's something really important to be aware of, to be mindful of. Some people will be like, hey, well, I don't see how anything significant is going to get through this little gap in my holster. Crazier things have happened. So,
I mean, that the exact thing has happened several times in the data set. And that's why we have to bring it up, right? If something can access the trigger and press it while the gun's in the holster, then this whole thing's for naught. Like, your holster is failing to perform its number one duty. The number one job of the holster is to prevent access to that trigger. So if it can be done, like, Murphy's Law will make it happen. yeah, it's a deal breaker. Like, can't carry a holster like that.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Number five is also dealing, as you mentioned, with holster rule number two, as we know it, which has to do with proper retention of the gun, which means, the best example that probably most people watching or listening are familiar with is the case of the FBI agent that happened right here in Denver, where we are based or close to, where an FBI agent performing a backflip, very impressive backflip, I might add. Yeah, dancing at a club or some kind of event, right? Does his backflip, and holster does not retain his gun at all. So his gun flies out of it. And of course, there's always that possibility, even though most modern guns don't have an issue with this, of it hitting the ground and discharging, but worse off is he kind of, panic grabs for it, because, like, that's not supposed to happen.
Yeah, that's a little embarrassing.
Right? Yeah. Unfortunately, grabs the trigger as he reaches for his gun and it discharges. So,
and hits somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Same thing, right? Like, we have the holster is not doing its job if it allows the gun to come out when it's not supposed to. Yep. So we have to have retention of the firearm to the holster that's appropriate for our situation.
Yeah.
And certainly, I don't think that most of us run around doing backflips. I'm certainly no longer capable of performing backflips, though one day we might say, Jacob, the guy who did backflips. However, certainly what is a true thing is that that's an activity that if your holster cannot retain the gun during a backflip, your holster is not going to retain it during a lot of other normal daily activities. Yeah. So your holster should be able to like hang upside down and retain the gun. That should be something it's capable of doing.
Yeah. And I know at one time I would even talk about like, hey, the way to test this is do this. I'm kind of moving away from that. I think that response, I mean,
do some vigorous jumping jacks if you want.
If you can render the gun inert, I actually have no problem with however you choose to test that. But that's what I would suggest is that you should render the gun inert.
You absolutely should render the gun inert before you test its retention of the holster. But how you test it's up to you. The point is, do you have absolute confidence that the gun will never leave the holster unless you intend it to?
Right.
That's the point, right? And you know what your daily activity is, I don't know. But you should be able to do jumping jacks. You should be able to run down the street. Like if you can't chase somebody or the guy who's grabbing your daughter, if you can't run down the street without your gun falling out of your pants and hitting the deck, we got a problem. Like the holster should retain the gun. I mean, Here's a sad one. So we have a guy in the data set who's putting his kid in the car seat.
I just told this story on Saturday at my class.
It's a tragic thing, right? Yes. Putting the kid in the car seat. He's wearing a shoulder holster as he's bending forward to stick the kid into the car seat. Gun just falls out of the shoulder holster, and he freaks out, goes to grab it, and discharges the gun, and boom, someone dies.
He dies.
Yeah, he's dead.
Shot himself.
He's dead now. Yeah.
I mean, you can imagine how that would happen, too, if you're using one of those horizontal carry shoulder holsters.
It's facing at you as it falls.
Yeah. And it comes out like this, and if you were to reach for it and a thumb went on the trigger, it's going to be pointing right at you. So
gun's got to be retained to the holster, folks.
Yeah. It's super, super, super important. I will say that with experience and time, and of course, we're working around holsters all the time now, but I have a pretty good sort of feel, and I'm not saying that everyone has this advantage, but I think with some experience too, you will sort of figure this out for yourself as well eventually. But I kind of have a pretty good sense about where it needs to be retention.
Sure, just filling it in and out of the holster. It is worth noting, just because a lot of people listen to this are regular concealed carriers you carry all the time, that a lot of holsters these days have adjustable retention. And I can tell, if you don't know this, then I'm telling you something you need to know. All screws loosen over time. And your holster is no exception. So making sure your retention screws, maybe the retention was great last time you checked it, but now you've been shoving this thing in and out of your pants for the last 6 months without really testing the retention, and it's slowly been working itself loose. So that's why all KSG holsters ship with thread locker. I don't know what brand we use, but it's a good, well-tested thread locker.
I'll tell you, it's Vibra-Tite VC3.
VC3 Vibra-Tite.
Yep.
It's like Loctite, but it's not. Anyway, so making sure you have a good thread locker on those retention screws and checking them regularly to make sure that they have not loosened or backed out and your retention has not decreased over time.
Yeah. Along with that, too, and this is sometimes where we see some failures is, and it's one of our holster rules, although it's not specifically called out here, and that is the importance of a gun being retained or the holster retaining itself to the body. You think of this in steps, right? First, holster protecting the gun and the trigger, making sure that's safe. Two, holster protecting the gun from falling out of said holster. And then number three, holster protecting yourself from holster suddenly, working its way loose off of your body when you don't want it to. I'm just going to slip that one in here, and especially in the discussion of screws, because I had a holster failure once upon a time that almost resulted in holster and gun and everything dumping itself out of my waistband, and it's because one of the clips that was clipped to my belt came loose. Had I had that, and that's honestly how a lot of times we learn these lessons to begin with, is from personal experience, and that was a lesson to me of, I should probably apply some thread locker to my hardware to ensure that doesn't happen again. There were other problems with that holster. Actually, I'm willing to say this. I was thinking about this recently, Jacob, but we haven't changed the cover image of the podcast since day one.
Oh, geez, that holster.
It's been 8 years?
20? Yes.
Yeah.
It has.
8 years of podcasting, and it's been the same image, which is of my OG inside waistband hybrid holster with a Springfield XDM 45 compact. Yeah.
In my pants.
And you were wearing it
for the sake of the photo shoot.
The photo that we were doing.
Yeah.
My goodness, how we've come.
We should probably change the logo.
Quite a ways,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, I've thought about that before, and it's like, you know, it's sort of like this reminder of
part of the legacy
where I've come from, you know, and the things we've learned over the years. It certainly wouldn't hurt to do a refresh. But I was just thinking, that's the holster.
You know,
I'm not calling out a specific
brand. You bring
up
a good point, though, like just to kind of bring us back a little bit, because some people, the retention is good enough to make sure the gun doesn't leave the holster when it's not supposed to, when the holster is actually on the body. Like if you're belt and the whole, you know, rig as it's installed on the body, it has sufficient retention. But when the holster is removed from the body, if now you no longer have sufficient retention to retain the gun, that's still problematic. Because we just got done talking, right? About the number one behavior was about administrative handling, and part of that was keeping the gun in the holster. So if your holster retention is dependent on the belt or the body, then that may not be sufficient to prevent negligent discharges and all these other things we're talking about.
It's actually one of the arguments why to not necessarily test, you know, to do a retention test just by, you know, I'm not going to do this, by the way, but by holding this upside down and shaking it, because even with this holster, its retention may change a little once it goes inside the waistband. Now, usually it's going to get firmer, right?
It should.
But yeah, no, you're not wrong in that, in what you're saying at all. It is good to be aware of. One of the challenges, though, and this is kind of why one of the reasons I moved away from hybrid holsters, meaning kind of like a leather backer with a kydex shell on the outside of it or something similar, is because those ones are the most susceptible to retention changes from, and it can be just from even sometimes from the actual belt and pants that you're wearing.
Sure.
There can be little variances there. And over time, the leather tends to soften up and the retention continues to change on you even when you don't expect it. And so those variables are a little bit harder to control for than something more like what we are akin to using and making today, meaning a full, you know, kydex or Bolteron shell holster that, I mean, it's just, well, there's a reason why this is what we're carrying today. It's just a superior option, is what I'm saying.
Bingo.
So, interesting discussion there. Final thing here, number six, finger discipline. I mean, this is a safety rule. We know this. We know it can be a thing. But yet, people still make mistakes. So,
yeah, this is one of those that would seem obvious, right? If I told you, hey, I'm going to talk about six behaviors that lead to negligent discharges, this would have been one that most people could have guessed at. Like, oh, probably something about finger discipline, not, you know, putting your finger on the trigger when you're not supposed to. Like, yep. Like, shocker, there's news stories in the data set about this one. I'm thinking about one right now where this guy, he's a firearm instructor, and he's holding some massive old revolver, like some 3D7 Magnum or something, some big beast of a thing.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's giving instruction, and one of his students is filming him. Like, and that happens to me all the time. I have students film me. So as one of his students filming, they're live on the range, and he's talking about, you know, this is how we're going to safely handle this gun, da-da-da-da-da-da, and then bang, his lights off around. And yeah, to make no mistake, his finger was on the trigger. Like, that's how the gun went off, is he pressed the trigger, right? I mean, you can take this basically as a fact, and I'm sure people could point out exceptions, but as a basic fact, guns, modern guns certainly, do not go off unless the trigger moves.
Yeah.
The trigger's got to move. Now, it's conceivable the trigger can move without you putting your finger on it, but basically, even your P320 won't go off unless the trigger moves. So we protect from negligent discharges by protecting the trigger. That's why we had the fourth behavior about holster protecting the trigger. Well, we also have to protect the trigger when we're handling the gun. And so, yeah, I mean, it's one of those obvious things, but you know, we have to talk about some of the nuance, perhaps, about how we get there and how we achieve that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the trigger finger discipline is for sure one of those things that is a learned skill, a learned behavior that takes time and careful practice to make sure that you are consistent in your application of that rule. Because we do so many other activities in our day-to-day lives where, you know, it's like I pick up my water bottle here to have a sip, and I mean, I pick it up with all four fingers and a thumb. You know, I go to use this is an Apple Pen for my tablet, but you know, what am I doing? I'm using my index finger along with other fingers. In most things in our life, when we grasp an object, we're grasping it with that index finger that is normally our trigger finger also being used. Yeah. So it's only natural. And I remember it was Dave Spaulding that really called this out in probably both of the two classes I took of his, talking about how for every one time we pull this trigger finger on the trigger of a gun, there's probably 1,000 or maybe even 10,000 times this gets used as part of other activities. Yeah. Yeah. And so you can see how important it is to reinforce the practice of keeping this finger straight, keeping it off the trigger, keeping it out of the trigger guard. And I really have, I mean, you know this about me. I talk about it in classes. We have our rule written the way our rule with regards to trigger finger discipline is as far as that's concerned. But I like to reference the home position, which I stole shamelessly from Jeff Gonzalez of Trident Concepts. I don't know where he got it or if it's, you know, uniquely his thing, but I like the idea of, hey, there is a default position that this trigger finger needs to be in for all of the times. I mean, all the times that we are not actually in the act of firing the gun. And that mean, and that's what, that's how I think of it now. This is the, like keeping it the finger straight and high and up on the frame of the gun. That's the default position. In other words, it should, it's the exception when we actually place the finger anywhere inside else. The trigger guard.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. And I think, and I, this is somewhat arbitrary. I don't have some data for this and I don't know how I could gather data for this, but I definitely have thousands of hours sitting on a gun range as an RSO, staring at people, watching them break safety rules. And the vast majority of the time when someone has a finger discipline failure, it's after they're done shooting. So there's, I bring this up because I think that this behavior is really two behaviors. Like to have good, solid finger discipline, you have to build two separate habits. The first habit of when I grab gun, when I, you know, draw the gun, pick the gun off the table, whatever, whenever I acquire the gun into my hand, my finger goes to the home position. It goes, you know, high above the trigger guard, you know, indexed wherever the thing is that we think is safe. But the second behavior, which I think is the more difficult habit to build, and the way I more often see this as a rule being broken, is when done shooty, you know, move finger out of trigger guard, put back in home position.
Yep.
And it's, I think, obvious and intuitive why that's a harder habit to build, right? Because the finger starts out in the bad spot. Like it initially is in the place we don't want it to be. So we have to build a habit of removing it and putting it back in the safe position. But yeah, I mean, I know this one's got a lot of like duh to it, this finger discipline thing, but got to bunch of stories in the data set from people failing to properly use finger discipline. And this is not, oh, the kid got the gun and the 12-year-old shot the other kid at the birthday party. These are gun owners. Like when we have finger discipline failures, this is us. This is our, this is us. Like this is me, Riley, and the people listening to us. This is one of us who's doing this. That, you know, we're at a gun range and we're actively handling guns and we just fail to have proper finger discipline. I'll tell you, there are some stories in the data set that are sympathetic squeeze problems, where the finger is outside the trigger guard, but it's still over the trigger guard, and something happens such that the finger, you know, puts pressure against that trigger guard and ultimately moves it enough that the finger slides into the trigger guard. Yeah. And generally, those are, you know, associated with the other hand doing something, trying to pick up, you know, grab the mag that's falling, or reacting to the loud noise, you know, that just took place on the range somewhere that we weren't anticipating, and kind of being surprised or shocked or bumped by somebody.
I remember Greg Elifert's article talking about sympathetic squeeze, where he mentions, I believe, a cop reaching to turn the knob on a door and, you know, then discharging the gun in his other hand because, you know, this hand is tightening, and that's why it's sympathetic squeeze. So this also tightens, and it is something to be aware of, to be mindful of. It can and does happen.
Yeah, but we reduce the risk by not having the finger over the trigger guard at all, by having it registered higher up on the frame or on the slide or something like that.
Absolutely. Yes, and I'm going to just kind of, as my own personal summary to this last point of this discussion, is throw us back to our rule number two of firearm safety as we teach it, which, again, that first half of the phrase is always be attentive when handling a firearm. So that doesn't just apply to attentiveness to where the muzzle's pointing or that kind of thing, but also what is this finger doing. I could tell you from personal experience, shooting competitively, going to a lot of matches, and having watched fellow competitors run from a position to a position or perform a reload while the finger remains inside the trigger guard, that when I have pointed that out, and I often do, I mean, it's not like it happens all the time, but occasionally I've seen that, and I usually will try to very politely and respectfully, just because I think that I believe that they would want to know, and kind of find an appropriate time to pull them aside and be like, just so you know, that when you did your reload back there on that stage, your finger stayed inside the trigger guard. And that is actually technically a disqualifying offense
if you're caught
by rules. Sure. Yeah, if the RO catches them doing that, and they are supposed to watch for that, but they don't always do that. But if I see that, and I'll pull them aside like, hey, you know, just it's just an FYI. You know, and usually they take that very well, very respectfully, as far as, oh, I had no idea. Thank you for letting me know. And that's the point, is you have no idea a lot of times when these sorts of things occur, because a lot of times your attention is elsewhere. You're focused on a different task that's at hand. In this case, maybe a reload, or it could be a variety of things. I mean, just shooting sure. a stage at a match is sometimes cognitive overload enough as it is, that you might not be as attentive about what's going on with your trigger finger and those sorts of things.
Yeah, I don't think I have more to add. I just think that you know, take all this in the you know, with as much humility as you can, and say, hey, are there any of these six behaviors that I'm failing to execute with energy and passion?
Yeah,
like I would think of it this way: like you, like, what's the title of the article I wrote? It's something about like follow these like it's religion. I think is what I put in the title.
It says six required behaviors to stop negligent discharges. Follow these like it's religion.
Yeah. So, you know, it requires passion is my point. Like a person, like I want you to hear these six behaviors and say, I'm going to be obsessive. I'm going to be compulsive. I'm going to be passionate about these six behaviors. Like I'm not going to be lazy fair about it. Like, like this is going to be like, man, this is what we do. As a community, as an individual, as a family, as a couple, as a whatever, like as a business, I can tell you we have policies in place that require these kind of behaviors be used when people are on site here at the business. Like we got to be passionate about it. We got to be energized. Like, no, these are deal breakers. Like these are things we're just gonna do.
Yep. Yep. Agreed. I think it's a great place to wrap it up. Thanks, everyone, for being a part of this episode with us, for tuning in both live or after the fact, whether via YouTube, Facebook, where this goes out, or on our podcast feed, which, of course, is available on Spotify and TuneIn Radio, and I think even technically on our iHeartRadio. I think it still shows up there, and Audible now, which is kind of crazy to me. But, guys, thanks so much for your support. A reminder that today's episode is sponsored and brought to you by BarrelBlock.com and KSGArmory.com. Any other final words?
I just appreciate you guys being with us today. I hadn't realized it's been 8 years we've been doing this. So for those of you, I'm going to just put out an ask, and I don't know how many will respond, but those of you who have been listening since the beginning, if you've heard every episode from episode one, I would love an email. I'd love for you to just give us a paragraph or two about what you've learned from this show and what it's meant for you. And we'll read those out over the air if we get them. I don't know if anybody will take the time. Half of you are probably driving while you're listening to this, but send us an email at podcast@concealedcarry.com. And we'd love to hear, you know, what 8 years has done for you.
Yeah. I appreciate you asking the listeners and viewers for that. That will be fun to see. I suspect that there are some that have listened since the very beginning. And that is humbling and honoring all at the same time. And it's probably a relatively small or short list.
you must really tolerate us. If you've been listening for 8 years and haven't given up on us yet, you must really not, you know, you must have nothing else to do.
Awesome. Well, brother, it's been good. Thank you so much, folks. Until next time, a reminder to train right, train often, and train safe. I'm going to throw it to you.
So you can fight hard, fight fast, and fight true.
Take care.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. Concealed Carry Inc., its brands and properties, and the Concealed Carry Podcast is not a legal service, nor are we attorneys at law. We make our best faith effort to share concealed carry-related insights and information about firearm-related incidents and the laws pertaining based on our own understanding and experience. But things can be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in this podcast. Please exercise care with all things pertaining to firearm use, concealed carry, and always practice following basic firearm safety rules. More information about safety can be found at concealedcarry.com/safety.